And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
Lakeshore Public Media will host Building Blocks Breakfast, Fueling the Future, on Wednesday, September 25th from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. at the Dean and Barbara White Community Center in Merrillville. This event will serve as the official launch of Lakeshore's Building Blocks Initiative, a comprehensive multimedia project aimed at exploring the science behind early childhood development, as well as the issues and obstacles that many families face, while also identifying tools and resources that can help give children the best start to a successful life. Joining me now to discuss this upcoming event, as well as share the vision behind Building Blocks, is Lakeshore Public Media's Vice President of Development, Carl Keurig, as well as the organization's Emmy Award-winning producer, Anthony Santucci, the Vice President of Production. Carl and Tony, thank you for joining me today on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure to be here, Dee.
Carl and Tony, again, Lakeshore Public Media will host a big event on Wednesday, September 25th at the Dean and Barbara White Community Center in Merrillville. And this event, this breakfast actually, will officially launch the new initiative, Building Blocks, Fueling the Future. I'm so excited to have both of you with me today in the studio to share all of the details of the day. But before we do that, Carl, take a moment to share a little bit about the vision of this multimedia project.
Yeah, so Building Blocks is a very exciting initiative for Lakeshore. It's been something we've been working on for a little over a year, and we are just taking the lead on an early childhood development initiative here. And Building Blocks, like you mentioned, is a multimedia campaign. So obviously there will be a TV production. We're doing a six-part series, and it'll be a multi-year series that we're looking to do, but initially a six-year series that will focus on the early childhood development. This is really the ages of like 0 to 3. And maternity and prenatal care and things like that as well. But also there will be some radio components to it and online podcasts and online resources. We're really just trying to make this be a one-stop shop for everything early learning and early childhood development. It started with the Strohsacker Early Learning Fellowship, which is run from First Things First Porter County. I went through that program, and it really just pulls in community leaders and people to, you know, champion early learning. And out of that, thought we'd have a good chance to pull together a really great program that again is multimedia. Mary Jane Eisenhower, who runs First Things First Porter County, and myself, we started pulling together a steering committee, started conversations, pulled Tony from Lakeshore in for the production aspect. And then when Chuck joined us here at Lakeshore, he had done a lot of early learning development work in West Virginia, where he was at previously. And so right away, he said, yes, we have to do this. He went through the Strohsacker program as well. And we've really just blossomed into this amazing program. Tony released the trailer for it, the promo for it, a week or so ago, and everybody's just talking about it and talking about the emotions that they're getting from it. And we've just been really proud of what we're doing, and that it's really going to impact early learning, early childhood development, and families here in Northwest Indiana, but potentially across the state with some of the partnerships we have with other stations.
Tony, this initiative is aimed at exploring the science behind early childhood development, as well as the issues and obstacles that many families face. For me, it was so important, and I told this to Carl probably 2 days ago, it was so important for me to have you a part of this conversation. Even though we're talking about the big breakfast, it was important for me to have you as a part of this conversation, because every time I talk to you about this project, I can literally see your passion for it. Your passion is what ignited my interest in this particular project. So I want you to take a moment to just give our listening audience a glimpse of what it was like for you to take on this major project.
Honestly, initially, it was a little scary. I tell a lot of stories about artists and people doing good things in the neighborhoods and, you know, restaurants and things like that with friends and neighbors and I in the arts. And this was a bigger scale project than used to doing, you know, and it feels like something where we really had to educate ourselves. And thanks to Mary Jane Eisenhower and First Things First and other people on the steering committee, it's been an easy process. You know, Mary Jane is so knowledgeable, but it's one thing to be knowledgeable and it's another to be able to convey that, you know, and she's done a great job of doing that and putting me at ease. And I've found that when you reach out to these professionals or these parents who are dealing with developmental issues, or parents that are just, you know, have kids that are just born, and they're opening up their homes to us and letting us just kind of take a peek at what that process is like raising a child, or dealing with a child who's, you know, might have an ongoing condition, or even just a child who's speech delayed, you know, and that's something that they'll get over because we have this early intervention initiative that we're trying to push as well. So it's been a learning process, but it's really pushed me to do something out of my comfort zone. And I look forward to what this might be in the future as well, not past these 6 episodes that we're initially committing to.
Absolutely. Again, as I shared with actually anyone that I have come into contact with leading up to this breakfast, your passion for this project, and I know the work that you have put in, it's really what has ignited my interest in it. And so I'm just so excited to have you a part of it. Now, Carl, Lakeshore Public Media is a nonprofit public media organization. And so like all nonprofits, we rely on the generous support of donations. And I understand the interest in this project has led to the award of several grants to Lakeshore Public Media. Take a moment to talk more about how the funds raised help further the vision and mission of this particular project.
Yeah, you really nailed it there. So we are, you know, a nonprofit public broadcaster. And, you know, when you look at community support, whether it's from local underwriters, individual donors, underwriting from businesses and things like that, event sponsorships, more than half of our revenue come from community support. And so, you know, this project has been one that community, and really we were down in Indy for a conference with other stations across the state, and it was a big topic there, and everybody was looking to us and talking about, you know, that we've kind of got the lead on this initiative that supports it. And so the reception of this has been amazing, and it is great to have people reaching out to us to talk about getting involved and supporting it. And yeah, it has led to a $100,000 matching grant from Legacy Foundation of Lake County, and a portion of that fund will fund an endowment. And so that, you know, definitely means long-term support for this initiative, which is what we want. We're trying to make this a 5-year initiative that we can, you know, at next point look at another age, but all under building blocks. So everything that takes to build a, you know, a child, from early intervention to a maternity care to at-home therapies and services. So we're just really looking for that investment, and Legacy's matching grant really legitimizes the multi-year investment that we have. We've had some great support from First Things First of Porter County, and our board member Sue Elotero and her husband Tom Sorlis have committed a generous gift to the match. And we have a lot of other individuals, Purdue Northwest and some other organizations and individuals who are really interested in helping us meet that match. And so, you know, we're pushing that out everywhere, and you can find more information about the match and building blocks in general and how to donate to that match at lakeshorepublicmedia.org/building blocks.
Carl, I understand this breakfast will, of course, feature great food.
Yes.
But it will also serve as an opportunity for attendees to network as well as connect with vendors. So share with our listening audience what they can expect on that particular day.
September 25th from 8 to 10 a.m. at the Dean and Barbara White Center in Maryville. We are having a great breakfast catered by Jay's Breakfast Club of Gary. And like you mentioned, Dee, there'll be a great opportunity for networking, you know, before, at the start of the program, after the program. We'll have the room full of a lot of local business owners, community leaders. There'll even be a lot of politicians and legislators in the room who are coming to hear more about the project. And so we're really excited about the names on the attendee list. We have over, I think we're around 250 or so confirmed now, and we're hoping that over the next week we'll close the gap and get right around 300 people committed to being at the event by purchasing tickets, again, at lakeshorepublicmedia.org/building blocks. And yeah, the event is going to really just serve as the launching event for Building Blocks. We're going to obviously share with the audience the story of how it came to be, what it is, what our intent is with Building Blocks over these next few years. And then we are going to actually give out some awards for champions of early childhood development in our community, in our region. So we're honoring Senator Ed Charbonneau for the bill he passed that's, you know, laying the groundwork for some changes, some really important changes to happen in childcare across the state. Mark Chamberlain, who's appointed by the governor to an early childhood advisory board, and Dr. Barbara Eason Watkins from Michigan City, who just recently retired but was pivotal in that school system for creating a pre-K, the Little Wolves Early Learning Center in Michigan City. She's just done amazing work to support it. So we're honoring them. And then, of course, the main thing that we're doing is sharing Tony's extended preview of the show, which if you go to lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks, watch the 2-minute trailer promo that we have out there. Just, you know, I'm very excited. I can't wait to see. I might even do, you know, like I do with movies in general, just avoid the trailer before we go there. So if Tony wants to show us before the event, I might wait and just watch it at the event. But just really excited to share that with everybody in the room. And I think that it's going to get people even more excited about it. So this event is going to be very important for Lakeshore, very important for Building Blocks as a program and an initiative that's affecting our community, and just a really great opportunity to network and get to know other people who are interested in supporting early learning and families across the region.
I think that it is so fitting that you shared. I was going to ask you to share more about the day, and I think that it is so awesome that it, in addition to the networking, and in addition to the breakfast, and in addition to seeing, obviously, the work that Tony is doing already, but to see so many champions of early childhood development be honored at this event as well. Yeah. I think it's going to be so awesome, and I think that it will be something that will connect the entire region. And so I'm so glad that Lakeshore Public Media is doing that as well.
Yeah, exactly, dear. And that's what we pride ourselves on, being that conduit, that connector, that megaphone in the community. And I think this is going to be another great example of how we're pulling the right people together in a room. And even more, I'm excited about the connections and the, you know, potential for additional great work to be done by connections that are made at this event. So looking forward to it. Hope everybody can make it. Again, tickets are available at lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks.
Tony, I want to turn back to you for just a moment, because I want to talk a bit more about this 6-episode series. You've had your hands in the project from the very beginning. So tell us more about what the series will cover, as well as when it will premiere on Lakeshore Public Media.
Sure. The series, so we mentioned that it's, you know, a scientific look, and that isn't inaccurate, but the science is what we know that works. And by we, I mean the experts that we're glad to partner with. But that story is told in a very practical way. I don't want people to think that this is, you know, a clinical study or anything like that. It's really taking those things we know based on science and closing that gap from that to how do we interact with our children. So it's really a practical application of science and things we know. I just want to make that clear. And then, so the first episode, which is what we'll be previewing at the breakfast, is kind of an overview of what to expect in that first 1,000 days, the scope of development, and also resources that are available, getting involved early with your children, and maybe kind of opening eyes to the fact that even though our understanding of that early childhood development has advanced in the last 10, 15, 20 years, people often still overlook how important those 3 years are, you know, to development of relationships and being aware of your environment and leading into executive function, which is kind of a child knowing their environment, knowing that they can engage with their environment, problem solving, those kinds of things. And then there's going to be another episode on perinatal health, which is basically prenatal through 1 year after birth of the mother and the child. That'll be episode 2. The third episode is about developmental milestones and how that's different for each child. Part of that will include early intervention, from everything to a lifelong disability or condition to maybe something that a lot of kids deal with is delayed speech, you know? So, and really normalizing the aspect of asking for help. There is help out there, and getting that help early is critical to getting your child to a point where they can maximize their early childhood development. Fourth episode will be everyday moments. So a big kind of push for this is that, you know, these are scientific concepts that are proven scientifically, but the fact that in everyday moments you can engage your child to develop, that might be as simple as talking through folding the laundry or making a snack or, you know, just simple things like that, or putting a building block castle together and you need a good foundation, you know, just those simple things early on, engage them verbally, get their brains working, and show that there's a relationship between you and the child. And I'm kind of oversimplifying these things, but that's why we're doing a 6-part
awesome
episode.
Awesome.
And then a big one that kind of opened my eyes was episode 5 is going to deal with what we call relational health. And that's just the idea that you as a mother, me as a father, Carl as a father, those things that we do to put our child in a space of feeling that they're in an open space, they're comfortable, that they feel it's a space where they can make mistakes and learn. And that kind of idea is critical to that child being open as they move on through their lives. You know, it's, I'm not putting this well, but that early relational health is one of those things that's very key, and that it's something that having a positive relationship with your child early on, it carries on throughout their whole development, you know, into adolescence and adulthood.
Absolutely.
So that was a kind of an eye opener, how early, you know, 0 to 3, because you're dealing with a child who, you know, we talk about stress in a child and you think, oh, you're a child, you have everything.
What do you got to worry about?
Yeah. But the fact is that these are children that they're hungry and they don't have self-advocacy to act upon that hunger, you know?
No,
so they're reliant on these relationships and just those kind of core relationship, you know, I give a cue as a baby and you as a parent soothe me or give me feedback or give me options on how to maybe soothe myself or get myself, advocate for myself. And as they start early, newborn, they're relying on the parents. But as they grow, they become more self-reliant because they have a parent advocating for them. And then the last episode, we want that to be a community conversation on how Northwest Indiana as a community can be a better community, or what we're doing well as a community to kind of make early childhood development a foundation for what we do, because it is our future. It is a big part of making this a stronger community. And I think it's just an initiative that Lakeshore is really proud to be a part of. And
absolutely,
our partners, you know, we're proud to have those partners as part of that initiative.
Again, I don't know if our listening audience can really hear what I hear from you every day when we talk about this project, because obviously you want to give the high points. You want to give it from the producer of this project. Obviously, you want to share the technical aspect of it. But even in you sharing high points of each of the 6 episodes, it is just so awesome, because even in you breaking that down, you've shared information, things that we never even consider. The communications, creating that safe place, creating that safe landing. And these are my words, not yours. But creating early on that safe space for children, it's not something that people typically think about. And so I love the way you will put a bow on it with that final episode of how can we as a region support our youth, because our youth, our children are the future. And so I think that the project is so awesome. It is so beautiful. And I just, again, I love your passion for it. Now, gentlemen, before I let you go, again, the Building Blocks Breakfast Fueling the Future is Wednesday, September 25th. So it's just a few days away. How can our listening audience find out more about tickets to this event, as well as any sponsorship opportunities?
Yeah, so we do have tickets available, and there are some sponsorships available. We do have to close that about a week out from the event, but we do have sponsorships available. Tickets are definitely available. And really, the one place to go for all this, lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks. And when you go there, right at the top of the screen, you're going to see the video. That's the 2-minute promo that Tony put together. Start there. That's why it's at the top. Watch that. Get excited. Feel the, you know, the energy that what we're trying to build here with Building Blocks. And it really gives you a glimpse of what this series will be and how it's going to be. It'll leave you with goosebumps. I promise it, everybody who's watched it has said the same thing. And when you scroll down from there, you can see information, just general information about Building Blocks, what the initiative is, the multimedia aspects of it. And then it'll also give you some information about that $100,000 matching grant from Legacy that we were awarded. And it has a quick button there for you to go and donate directly to Legacy. It'll go right into that match. And again, part of that will start an endowment for Lakeshore's educational programming, just like Building Blocks, and really lay the foundation for a multi-year initiative. And then right below that, you'll see all the information about the breakfast, the event, who we're honoring, all the details. We'll keep adding more details as they come there. And again, another link to just click and look at the tickets and the sponsorships that are available. So if sponsorships are cut off, you'll see it there. But otherwise, you'll be able to purchase tickets, and you can, you know, definitely share that with anybody who you think might benefit from being in the room with all these educators, the people in the fields, the experts, the people with a passion for early learning will all be in this room. Like I said, from individuals who work in the field to educators to legislators and everybody in between. So definitely lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks is the one place to go to learn everything you need to know about Building Blocks.
Carl Keurig is the Vice President of Development, and Anthony Santucci is an Emmy Award-winning producer, as well as the Vice President of Production with Lakeshore Public Media. Carl and Tony, again, it is an honor and a privilege to have you both in studio with me, sharing all of the details about Lakeshore Public Media's newest initiative, Building Blocks Fueling the Future. Again, I thank you guys for joining me, and we look forward to a successful event on Wednesday, September 25th at the Dean and Barbara White Community Center in Merivale.
Thank you, Dee.
Appreciate the time, Dee.
Lakeshore Public Media's early development efforts align with the mission of PBS stations, which reach more families with young children in low-income homes than any other children's TV network. By leveraging the extensive reach of public broadcasting, this program will serve as a valuable resource, particularly for underserved and underprivileged families. For more information, visit www.lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The state of education has been at the forefront of many public debates the last few years. Everyone, from parents to politicians, have made it a point to offer their opinions on what should and should not be taught in the classroom. Teachers are often overworked, underpaid, feel unsupported, and many have contemplated leaving the profession altogether. I recently had an opportunity to speak to New York Times bestselling author Alexandra Robbins about her new book, The Teachers. Here's the conversation. Alexandra, where do we even begin? Chapter 1 of your book opens with a quote from a Maryland school administrator, and it really sets the tone for the ride the reader is about to embark on. It says, and I quote, "Long-term subs are really hard to find, so I need you to not get really sick or pregnant this year," end quote. All I could think as I read those lines is, wow, buckle up. This is about to be a bumpy ride. In full transparency, I'm married to a career public school educator, and so I have been privy to a firsthand account to stories similar to the ones you shared in your book. Now, before we get into your latest book, The Teachers, which shines a light on the crisis in America's school system right now, I want you to take a moment to talk about yourself, your storied career, as well as some of your work that our listeners may be familiar with.
Well, I'm an investigative journalist. I usually end up on the education beat. I wrote a book called Pledge, The Secret Life of Sororities. I've written about fraternities. I've written about high school students doing the college admissions process, high school student outsiders. I wrote a book called The Nurses. My style is basically, it's nonfiction, but it's the kind of nonfiction I like to read. It's sort of fast-paced, fun-to-read fiction-style stories that follow people throughout a year. So with The Teachers, I wanted to write a book that was really interesting to read and that people would be able to find characters to root for and relate to, that also showed them what's really going on inside schools, and that shows teachers they're deeply appreciated, they're not alone, and people will fight for them. I wanted the book to be the kind of thing that people can give teachers as a gift to show them their support and appreciation.
So as I shared, I am in fact married to a teacher, and again, I must say your new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession, does an excellent job of lucidly illustrating the realities of teaching over the last few decades. In the book, you pinpoint exactly when the shift began, and as a result, while duties and responsibilities continue to pile on and on, and on, there is really no concession made in terms of additional planning hours, access to additional talent and or resources, and so on to help teachers manage it all. So let's talk about what some of your research revealed that ultimately can lead to, and in many instances, led to teacher burnout.
Teacher burnout is something I talk about because I think it's a really misleading term. So the teaching profession started declining in the early 2000s. As you said, when districts started piling on and piling on and piling on, it started with the government's focus on high-stakes standardized testing, which really changed the game for teachers because suddenly their paychecks and their jobs could hinge on how their students happened to do on one specific test on a random day. And it didn't matter to the scores if a child was well-fed or had parental involvement or was neglected at home or had just experienced a trauma or really just like came to school with a stomach ache. You never know with those test scores. And yet teachers were being judged on them. That sort of started this competitive atmosphere of fear. And even though now there aren't as many punitive measures with these tests, the high-stakes tests still exist, and districts have now been piling these responsibilities on teachers for about 20 years. So burnout. Teachers are said to burn out when they are stressed or exhausted from overwork. And teacher burnout is so popular that The Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the definition of burnout, both contextual examples mention teachers. However, experts say that teacher burnout is caused by inadequate workplace supports and resources, high-stakes testing, unmanageable workload, things like that. But instead of fixing these issues, school systems don't. They put it on the teachers. They say, oh, well, the teachers should just do a better job of self-care. And so the phrase teacher burnout, it blames teachers for not being able to cope instead of blaming the school systems that are setting teachers and students up to fail. So that's why I say, instead of saying teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying school districts are the employers who are worst at providing employees with the proper supports and resources.
Now, I want to share with you, Alexandra, that the book actually gave me a gut punch as well. As I am fully aware of the demands that come with teaching, I selfishly complain on Sunday evenings whenever my husband spends those last few moments of our off day doing what? Working on lesson plans for the week, or grading papers, or even, quite frankly, just sitting in his office, head in his hands, as he tries to give himself a pep talk to prepare for the week ahead. In the book, The Teachers, you are keen to point out that teachers really don't have the plush work schedule with summer vacations, holidays off, and half days that other professions envy. The quote-unquote off days are really days spent in professional development, curriculum planning, assignment grading, and so on, right?
Right. So teachers only have maybe 50 minutes of planning time per day in school. And for some reason, they're expected to do all their grading and planning and prepping in that 50 minutes. That 50 minutes is often eaten up by meetings with other teachers, meetings with administrators, meetings with students, having to call parents because of some behavioral issue or academic issue or something else. Those precious planning time minutes, they end up, I don't know, let's say you get maybe 5 or 10 minutes out of that total. So there is no possible way for teachers to complete their job during their paid contractual hours. That's why teachers are working late into the night. You know, high school and middle school teachers, they can easily have 180 students. I spoke to a teacher in Utah who had 263 students one year. She was a high school English teacher. Can you imagine having to grade, refine, edit, and correct the writing of 263 student essays every time you have to do an assignment? I mean, it's mind-boggling. There's not enough time for teachers to get the job done in the hours that they are paid for.
So I had the opportunity to interview Glenieva Dunham, who is the American Federation of Teachers Indiana Union President, before the start of the 2022-2023 school year. And she shared with me in the interview, and I'm paraphrasing, the same sometimes deplorable conditions like lack of proper air conditioning are the work conditions of teachers. And it was in that moment that I actually took a step back and realized that I never looked at the profession from the perspective of the teacher. So have you received feedback sharing that sentiment as well?
Yeah, because I talk about that in the book as well. Rebecca, one of the teachers I followed for a year for the book, the heating and air conditioning didn't work in her classroom. And so she has to give the kids standardized tests and things like that, and it felt like 100 degrees in the classroom. She said students were draped over their desks because it was just heat fatigue. And she and many other teachers keep winter jackets and like tank tops in their rooms because they never know what the temperature is going to be in their classroom. I spoke to a teacher who, she's allergic to rodents, but there were rodents in her classroom that the school couldn't afford to get rid of. And she would, she would, she was an art teacher. She would find them in her art closet. She would find droppings in her drawer, in her desk drawers. And she was supposed to be the one to clean it up because they just didn't have enough staff to stay on top of all that. Yeah, the working conditions for teachers are pretty appalling in some cases, and people don't really think about it that way, as you said. They don't realize that, you know, when there's no working water fountain in a school, students don't have that, but neither do teachers. And yeah, you can bring your own water bottle, but teachers really don't have time to go to the bathroom during the day. So, you know, there are all sorts of things that people don't realize about teachers. And that's one thing that I hope the book gets across.
Alexandra Robbins' new book, The Teachers, is available in bookstores or wherever you buy books. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The Memorial Opera House reopens this evening following a four-month, $5 million renovation. Marketing coordinator Zachary Mullins recently discussed the project with Lakeshore Public Media's Michael Gallenberger. Mullins says it's the first large-scale renovation of the historic building in decades.
So the building was originally constructed in 1893. It was originally known as Memorial Hall. It was constructed as a veteran memorial for veterans of all wars. There was the last major renovation was in the 90s. I can't give you the exact date off the top of my head, but that was the last time the interior was really majorly redone. I know about 4 or 5 years ago, there was like minor, like I think like just carpet replacements or something. But this is the first time in decades that we have fully closed down the building for this like expanded amount of time and fully redone the inside.
And what are some of the things that happened and what changes are people going to notice when they return to the venue?
So the main thing is I want to assuage any fears people may have that we're getting rid of all the historical value of Memorial Opera House. Memorial Opera House is registered as a historical landmark, and so actually the facade on the outside cannot be touched by us legally. So we are keeping that completely the same. We wouldn't want to touch it anyways. We think it's beautiful. We think the historical significance is amazing. As far as what our community should expect to see changed, the interior is going to look completely different. We moved the front arch out a little bit to expand the room we have in our box office and front bar. We knocked down a couple walls. So originally when you walked in, there was a bit of a foyer. Off to your right, there was a separated room for the box office. And off to your left, there was a separated room for the bar. Now when you walk in, it's going to be just one big opening space. We're going to have a mobile box office. We're going to have our bar right there. That should help us not only minimize the lines we would sometimes experience during shows, but it also just makes everything feel more cohesive and open. We're also really focusing on elevating the space as well. We pride ourselves on putting on really high quality productions and events, and we want the space to match that vibe. It just seems very elevated compared to how it was in the past. I think once the community sees it from themselves, they'll know what I'm saying exactly. But like, we have really nice light fixtures. As far as the theater itself, that was also completely redone. We have brand new carpeting in there. We have brand new theater seats. We would always get comments about our theater seats having springs poking out of them or something like that. So that will no longer be an issue. These seats are brand new, as well as there's some additional leg room with these seats. So we're happy with that. We're currently doing a legacy campaign in which if anyone donates to our Memorial Opera House Foundation, they get to name one of these seats for 5 years. They can have any name they want on these seats for 5 years. Our stage is getting a little bit of a revamp. It's going to look a bit nicer. The entire theater was painted a really beautiful blue. The loge boxes were redone to about the same color. I think it's a bit like a deeper, more richer gold, but it's still the same vibe. Our like little tech area in the back of the theater that a lot of patrons notice when they first walk in, we just made that a little bit bigger so that way we're capable of doing more exciting and fun things. And the last major change is going to be upstairs with our Roosevelt room. So originally we had a cute little blue room upstairs. It had a second bar that was slightly smaller and a second private restroom. It is still going to have a bar and a private restroom as well. However, we've just sort of opened the space up a bit. It's painted white now, and that's going to be more of a lounge area. For instance, our very first event this weekend, Laugh for Life, we're doing a VIP ticketing option, and those VIPs get access to the Roosevelt Room Lounge. We're doing some stuff downstairs too in the basement, but you know, patrons aren't going to be able to see that as much. And that's the major stuff for the renovations. Like I said, the entire interior is getting redone, and we're really excited for the community to see it. We think they're going to enjoy it a lot.
And I know there's been kind of lots of discussion over the past few years in county government about the scope of this project and, yes, you know, how much it should be. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about why this was needed, the renovations that did take place.
Right. So as you've mentioned, these renovations were a discussion for a long time. I only recently started with Memorial Opera House at the beginning of the year, so I don't know the full extent of all these conversations. But I do know that these renovations were deemed necessary because, like I said, we pride ourselves on being a community theater that puts on high quality events and productions for our community. And the space was, it was aging. There was paint chipping. Like I said, patrons were complaining about springs sticking out of the seats. in between shows during intermission, we'd have a huge, like, bunched up line at our front bar. And so we realized that there was stuff we could do to make it a better experience for our community. And, you know, that's the whole point of Memorial Opera House. So eventually they, you know, went through with it. It was just about, you know, getting through all the red tape.
They understand some shows had to be canceled or moved around or, you know, whatever. Right. Can you kind of talk about some of the challenges you had to work through to get this renovation going?
The initial thing was our cancellation of Guys and Dolls, which was supposed to be our musical performance for the summer, this summer of 2024. Of course, we have to pre-plan all of our seasons like way in advance, half a year to a year in advance sometimes. And that's just due to the rights, like details with contracts and rights with theatrical companies. Like in order to purchase rights to certain shows, we needed to have like plenty of time and like in advance in order to like discuss and work out and all those details. So we had our 2024 season lined up well before the renovations were finalized, which is why, unfortunately, we had to turn around and cancel a show. Of course, a lot of people were like, you're a county entity and the county is like doing these renovations. So like, you should have planned for that. Of course, we knew these renovations might happen, but we also knew that they might not. And we didn't want to have nothing going for the summer. And so we figured it was just a better bet to plan on it not happening just in case. So that way we would still have something for the community in case we didn't renovate. Of course, we did renovate and we are happy about that. Though we unfortunately did have to cancel Guys and Dolls, which is a very popular show. I myself was disappointed, but there's always the future, you know. As far as other things, there haven't been too many other challenges, really. Construction has gone smoothly. We've just been really thankful to the community, honestly, for sticking with us through these renovations. Memorial Opera House has had its doors closed for almost four entire months. Once Beautiful ended on May 12th, we striked at the same time we emptied out the building. It was chaos. But like we have events on Saturday and Young Frankenstein is coming up at the end of the month and tickets are still selling. We still have a community backing us and we're extremely grateful and happy to see that people realize that these renovations are going to be worth it.
That's Memorial House Marketing Coordinator Zachary Mullins speaking to Lakeshore Public Media's Michael Gallenberger. The Opera House officially reopens this evening with a ceremony rededicating the facility as a memorial to all veterans. It'll include remarks from Judge Michael Fish, the Porter County Commissioners, and the Memorial Opera House Foundation Board. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The MAC Foundation First Responding Training Campus is proud to announce the 5th Annual First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day set for Saturday, September 14th. This highly anticipated event will take place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the MAC campus. The First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day is a free, family-friendly fun event for all ages and serves as the organization's largest fundraiser of the year. The day is dedicated to honoring and supporting our first responders by providing them with comprehensive and inclusive training and skill enhancement opportunities. This year's event will feature over 80 attractions and a wide variety of first responder disciplines, showcasing the skills and dedication of our local heroes. Attendees will have the opportunity to engage with first responders, learn about their work, and learn firsthand the expertise and bravery required in their line of duty. Joining us now to share more about the big event is Selena Weatherwax, the president and CEO of the MAC Foundation. Selena, as always, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. We appreciate so much the partnership with Regionally Speaking. Thank you.
Selena, the MAC Foundation will host their 5th Annual First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day this Saturday, September 14th. And I'm so excited to have you with us to share all of the details of the day. But before you do that, take a moment for someone out there that may not be familiar with the MAC Foundation. Take a moment to share the vision as well as the mission of the MAC Foundation, as well as why do you even exist?
We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization committed to supporting the first responder community. We support firefighters, law enforcement, dispatchers, correction officers, you name it, EMTs, paramedics. And our mission is to ensure that we have the training facilities available to first responders at no cost to them or their agencies. And we do so because these men and women deserve to have access to quality training opportunities right here in their backyard. We started 8 years ago and continue to grow as a foundation, but also to increase and maximize our reach. We are doing a number of different things that take us beyond the region as well.
So, Selena, the day is dedicated to honoring and supporting our first responders by providing them with comprehensive and inclusive training and skill enhancement opportunities as well. Can you take a moment to give a glimpse of what the day will look like, as well as how regular citizens just like myself can take part in the day?
The First Responder Appreciation Demonstration Day will begin at 9 a.m. this Saturday, September 14th, and it will be hosted here on our campus. The campus is normally not open to the public, with the exception of public classes like CPR and self-defense classes. But on Saturday, we will have a series of demonstrations that are led by our first responders themselves. And it's an opportunity for the community and citizens to come and see how these men and women prepare for their jobs, for their professions. So it's an opportunity for them to see how hard they work, to prepare for when an emergency arises, but also it's also an opportunity for them to get to know each other better, to improve communication synergies, and quite frankly, build stronger relationships.
Selena, at the start of our conversation, you noted that the MAC Foundation is a nonprofit organization that offers quality training services for our first responders. With that, like all nonprofits, you rely on the generous support from community members via donations, be it sponsorships, etc. Now, I understand the annual First Responder Day serves as a fundraiser. Take a moment to talk more about how the funds raised via sponsorships, via events like this, how they help further the vision and mission of your organization.
Because the MAC is a nonprofit, we actively seek out support, not only from individual donors, but also from corporate leaders and different organizations from throughout the country, quite frankly. And we do so because we want to be sure that the MAC continues to be offered at no cost to the first responders, the people at the core of our mission, or at little cost to them. And we work very hard to put on this specific fundraiser this Saturday, but we also do quite a bit during the year to make sure, again, that these men and women are supported and have access, and that the financial constraints that departments and agencies experience is not an issue. And so we can do the work on the fundraising front so that they can have the access they need to the training that they need.
And I should note, in addition to the training that you provide, I love the addition of the mental health component. Speak a little bit about how you guys are supporting our first responders through your mental health initiative.
Our mental health initiative was really something that we have been talking about for quite some time, that launched at the start of last year. And the reason that we did that is because oftentimes first responders told us that we have done a good job at helping them be supported on the physical aspects of their positions, but not such a good job on the mental side of things. And so we have a year-long initiative in place where we are offering different trainings here on the campus and also offering access to different clinicians that are specialty trained in working with the specific population. And so all these things we're doing because we want to support these individual men and women on a very holistic point and want to be sure that they are healthy and in the careers they have chosen to serve our communities.
Now, Selena, I want to return back to the reason that you're with us today, and that's to discuss the 5th Annual First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day. Now, I understand this year's event will feature a number of live demonstrations from various first responder disciplines, showcasing their skills and dedication of our local heroes. Can you, again, take a moment to tell us what we can expect to see on that day?
We can expect to have 3 different helicopter landings throughout the day. We have a number of our federal partners that will be joining us, as well as many of our local agencies. We'll have canine demonstrations. We will have series of demonstrations on how to properly put out fires, and more importantly, how to get out of harm's way in an event that you experience an emergency. And of course, for the kids, in partnership with Lakeshore Public Media, we will have Clifford the Big Red Dog here on site. So a lot of fun, interactive things. This event is free and it is family friendly, not necessarily pet friendly, because we have many working dogs here on site that day, but certainly an opportunity for the families to come out and get a series of demonstrations for them to view, but also to experience different things.
Selena, so you named all of the events and activities that will take place on this day, and I can't help but note that this is a huge undertaking, to say the least. And in the past, you have had crowds of at least 3,000 people. So I just have to ask you, are there opportunities for community members to take part, to volunteer for this day?
We do. We have 163 volunteer slots that we need to pull this event off. And we are really fortunate in the response, and many of the slots are already filled, but we will always welcome volunteers here at any point during the year. After this event on Saturday, we have our Haunted House Charity Fundraiser. And at that, we also need more volunteers and actors to participate in the attraction itself. So yes, always contact us at the MAC, and we'd be happy to coordinate a time for volunteers to come and help us out.
If anyone has any question about not only the 5th Annual First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day, or they would like additional information on how they can volunteer not only for this event, but also in the future, where can they go to get information?
Our website is www.MAAC foundation.org. And our phone number is 219-510-9111. Again, 219-510-9111.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guest, and we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.